Anybody who says they don't miss me can leave. And anybody who says they miss me too much can come and check. and receive part of Yunus Karim's salary for the day. So all of that is up for grabs. Who's going to start? Oh, I like that. We sit once a week. look, it's tough, hey. It's tough, let me tell you. Public enterprise is tough.
Yeah, you know.
Now, look, you know, it's terrible because old habits die hard, and I don't have Lolly here today. So, Mr. Roman, I hope you have an extra pen because Lolly always carries an extra pen. Look, I don't think that, I was just discussing with Yunus now, I don't think, okay, we're in session. I don't think that we are going to finalize the bill today. We are going to, as you know, we've redrafted some of the provisions based on our previous discussions, and that's really what we're presenting here today. I hope, Mr. Dubert, for your invitation as well, to take the bill to our caucus on Thursday. And there is, once we do that, we're then able to vote as parties. And yes. Oh, yes, it's the workshop. Is it on Wednesday or Thursday? Thursday. Oy, 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 that's going to be difficult. Because we were hoping to vote on Friday and then debate on the 21st, which is the three-day rule and so on. So that's going to be a bit of a problem. I think what we must try and do in any case is to, because you see, if we don't, that means we don't pass the session in the National Assembly, and that's going to be a hell of a problem for us. And I certainly am not getting paid to salary. So I'm not coming back. Pardon? Take it to the political committee as an option, I guess, yeah. They can, but the problem is, when do we debate in the House? Because even if they, the problem is your caucus. Really, that's the problem. Do you have an alternative to your caucus that you can possibly take? Because Ms. Landers just pointed to me that in the ANC we have an alternative to the caucus where we can get some kind of political agreement. Will you do that? Because I think you must say to them that the big imperative is for us to finalize this thing and vote in the National Assembly before we arrive this year. And we're not going to be able to do it. Even if we were to take it to our caucuses on the 22nd, we can't possibly hope to debate it on the 23rd because there isn't a sitting on the 23rd. Not a sitting of the House. So that's really the problem that we have. So if you can please just come back to me on that issue. Come back to me on the matter because I'm running with the process. And let me just for the record state that the formal co-option in terms of the rules having had taken place previously with the chairperson, I am now sharing this on his behalf. And that co-option stands until we finalize the certainly this bill and whatever comes back from the NCOP in terms of the sexual offences, RICA, and I'm not sure what other things are there, but I think it's just those two bills. So we won't have to go through the motion of the formal co-option every time I take over the chair. I take it that we are all in agreement with that. thanks very much. Okay, we don't have too much time, and we do have quite a few amendments to go through. I want to suggest, Mr. DeLange, that we start with Section 11, because Mr. Joubert particularly has to leave. We then go on to the register, Mr. DeLange, and I think the code. Those three things. And then when Mr. Joubert leaves, at least you've got the substantive issues completed. And then the rest, for the rest, Lynn, Mr. Joubert, it's the technical stuff, adjustments and so on, which is not really substantial. So at least you have been taken through the substance of the things, okay? So members, please turn to Section 11. Everybody's got the draft. What was your last index, Mr. DeLange, on this one?
Sure, I'm sorry, I don't have the index, but this one will say 13 November, the date at the top right corner of the document.
Okay, you guys will just check with Lolly the next time what your index is. So that you know which draft you're at, okay? Section 11 on page 8. Mr. DeLange, take us through some of those changes. Unfortunately, we don't have the color tracking, but you can see, those of you who have good eyesight, who are young and vigorous, you can see that there is a slight difference in hue and texture. We're being led by the blind today. Bear with us, it's going to be a bumpy ride.
Bear in mind that in the line of the blind, land of the blind, of one eye is king.
Yes.
I don't know where I sit.
Are you making insinuations about the honourable members and their
I'm looking for the one-eyed membership. See, the first subsection there is 11.1. Members will recall that there used to be a provision that there will be a list, basically a blanket prohibition on judges in active service receiving any outsource allowances or remuneration, whatever, and there used to be a provision that there was a list that the minister might publish in the Gazette, where there could be written exceptions to that rule. Nothing changed that it is really a blanket prohibition on all judges in active service from receiving any services, fees, emoluments, allowances, etc. But with the proviso added that the judge may, with the written consent of the minister, acting in consultation with the Chief Justice. In other words, it's really the written consent of the minister with the concurrence of the Chief Justice. That those judges may receive royalties for legal books written or edited by that judge. As far as the judges who had been discharged from active service are concerned, we still have a provision that they may, with the written consent of the minister acting after consultation with the Chief Justice, hold or perform any other office of profit or receive in respect of any fees, etc., allowances apart from his or her salary and any other amount which may be payable to him or her in his or her capacity as a judge. Now, members might recall that in the older version, there then were certain criteria. There was a provision that the minister would publish in the Gazette criteria that he or she would consider when considering these requests to receive this other amount, but that's been redrafted now in sub 3, saying that written consent may only be given if the minister is satisfied that the granting of that consent will not, one, adversely affect the efficiency and effectiveness of the administration of justice, including the undermining of any aspect of the administration of justice, especially the civil justice system, will adversely affect the image or reputation of the administration of justice in the Republic. Secondly, in any manner undermine the legal framework which underpins the judge for life concept. Thirdly, result in any judge engaging in any activity that is in conflict with the vocation of a judge. and fourthly could bring the judiciary into disrepute or have the potential to do so. Then goes on to say the minister acting after consultation with the Chief Justice made by noticing the Gazette, issue guidelines regarding any other criteria to be applied when considering the granting of consent. In other words, we still have the guidelines that could be published in the Gazette, which will guide the minister and the Chief Justice when it comes to requests for this extra remuneration, but the Act itself will lay down the basic guidelines. So any other guidelines will be in addition to this, but this will be the basic parameters set by the legislation itself. And then there's a sub C, written consent may be granted on the conditions, if any, that the minister deems appropriate, just so as to make a decision that you can give conditional consent. And fourthly, that the minister must cause the registrar of judges registrable interests to receive all instances where written consent is contemplated in subsections 1 and 3 are granted. Then a new 5 is added on the next page, that the minister must once every 12 months table a report in Parliament containing particulars including the outcome of every application made in terms of sub 1 or 2, especially in respect of each application granted and any conditions attached thereto during the period covered by the report.
Consent in writing, but nowhere do we say that the judge has to apply in writing. Does it infer that he applies in writing, or we have to say it?
What is the regulation that any case saying?
It could, yeah, it's wide enough. As the provision stands at the moment, there's also not a requirement that you have to apply, but that is what happens in practice. Of course, if you can only act with certain consent, surely you must request it.
But also, then the
No, but that's not the point anymore. The real issue is that you have to receive written consent. So even if it is oral, the point of the matter is that in order to perform the service, you would have to have in your possession written consent.
Sorry, but I really think that what you do is straight. And the application must be written. So there's no misunderstanding 3 years down the line when consent submission is allowed. Everyone has to go back and say, look, the judge told me to make a written submission. Rather than a situation where
character, because that's called fair function. Later on, they get a
written consent.
Yes.
But if the written consent is there, there's no controversy of what I'm saying.
It could be a very
yes. About the permission.
Yes.
Oh, I see. What was actually applied for. Okay. Can't we in that, sorry, Mr. Michael Nish, you have your hand up as well.
Yes. And if you meet with me after first midnight, you ask for your consent, I might say that I will write it, I will give it to you, and then it is not forthcoming. It can result also in some tension that I asked you to do this and you didn't do it. So it might be that in some, so it should be proper that it is a system. Because there is some paper trade.
In sorry, is there somebody else
who
wants to say? I want to propose a way forward. In 3D, Mr. DeLanga, can we not add something there to say that the minister may issue regulations pertaining to the application and granting of such an application in terms of restriction or something of that sort, something broad, so that even if there are issues that we haven't conceived of, administrative issues, but that also can be complied. Something like, I mean, the other thing that I'm thinking about in terms of, which is more bureaucratic than it is necessarily of a legislative nature, is what is the time period? Shouldn't there be stipulated time periods when you can perform something? So just because you've been given permission in a particular instance to perform, I don't know, as a circuit act, that doesn't stand for all time. It actually has an expiry date, so to speak. But all of those things can be captured in regulation, surely, Mr. Gala. What is your suggestion?
I would suggest that it is off the cuff, but in both cases, one could say in the provisor to one, and then in two also. May with a written provided that the judge may on application to the minister in prescribed manner insert that there. I think one could insert the same.
You know, I'm worried about that, because what we really are also interested in is the written consent. So you say by way of written application to the minister doesn't mean that the consent is going to be written. That's why I'm saying that perhaps what you should do is just allow for a general enabling clause to say the minister can regulate applications both in one and two, something like that.
Yes, strictly speaking, if we turn to page 22, clause 35, yes,
uh-huh,
it is already fairly widely framed as it says in 35.1b, may make regulations regarding any matter that may be necessary or expedient to prescribe regarding, I think it's a Roman 1, a Roman 2, and one could add a Roman 3 then, with a specific reference to applications referred to in section 7.
Can you make a specific reference to section 11?
11, yes.
Yeah, I think that may help. Okay? And then it will cover all of these things. It won't just cover the issue of written application, but every other element of it. Okay. So we make special reference to specific reference to session 11. Happy? Anything under under the criteria are new. I think we must look at the criteria for judges who are not on active service. You recall previously that we said the minister can issue criteria, which is so rare. If you look at D there, 3D still has that element to it. But I thought that it would be appropriate to set out the criteria, even if the minister doesn't issue those, because now it's a may. But the criteria that we've devised, they are new. Can I ask Mr. DeLange, that first one, you've collapsed the efficiency and effectiveness as well as the reputation of the criminal, the justice system. Now, I'm wondering whether there is any merit in breaking that up as two separate things, or do you hold firmly to the view that it should be one and the same? Oh, I'm sorry. The criteria under 3A, Mr. Hubert. We still with Section 11. Members with me?
Yeah.
Okay, so you'll see that there's Roman 1 to 4. That's the criteria that we've now put in legislation. In other words, if those criteria are present, the minister cannot apply her discretion and grant permission for judges not on active service to proceed with whatever other work they want to do. The first one says adversely, it says the grant of such consent can't happen if the application to do the work will adversely affect the efficiency and effectiveness of the administration of justice, including the undermining of any aspect of the administration of justice, especially the civil justice system, or adversely affect the image or reputation of the administration of justice in the Republic. What say you, Mr. DeLange?
I don't have any particular strong views on that. The original thought was just to add to sub 1 there the part about all the image or reputation of the administration of justice in the Republic. Then I thought that one could either make that a separate 2 or add it to 1 in the manner that I did there, because I suppose this to a quite a large extent this is a repetition of what is already in 1. It is really just an elaboration on 1, but I don't think I don't have a particularly strong view one could break it up. I could make a view that that is more appropriate.
The special reference to civil justice, would that include arbitration? Or, I don't know, for me it would.
Not all arbitration, it's a matter of degree, I would imagine. So if, for example, in a particular jurisdiction, all civil matters go to arbitration, that clearly undermines the court. But in another jurisdiction, the reason why it goes to arbitration is because that court rules are full and so on and so on. That clearly works. Well, whatever the case, what I'm saying is that the criteria is, will it undermine? And if it undermines, then clearly there's a problem. But it won't per se exclude arbitration. That's not what this is meant to do. Arbitrations per se do not undermine the civil justice system. What it potentially can do, though, in a particular jurisdiction where people, for example, feel, well, the judges sitting in the civil courts here are, you know, they're unpredictable or whatever it is, and you're not, as a matter of course, going to take our civil matters there, then clearly there's a problem. So I think that's really what is envisaged. It's not a bar on arbitration by any means. Ms. Imam Solomon?
Mr. Lyon said that Roman 1 actually that is a system, you know, what being said in the beginning. And there are two issues there. Firstly, it is the efficiency and effectiveness of the administration of the country. The second issue is the reputation of the interpretive position of the position. That you can separate those positions. See, for example, like that, he is busy with something else, right? And he can open the text, he will be affected with the self-use of the work in English. But secondly, even if the judge is so busy, maybe people in all companies, you know, classification, and the sector of the judiciary. I think we can separate those two. You know, collapse of that two issues involved here. The technical administration, and secondly, the reputation of the position.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. And I think that there's another problem here, Mr. Delanda. I think that the word and in after Romans 3 must be or, as Imam says. And secondly, I think also that perhaps what you should do is from the words adversely affect the image of image or reputation of the judiciary or the administration of justice in the Republic, and that should be now a separate issue.
Yeah, that's
true. Okay, can we agree to that?
One sentence, mm-hmm. Bear in mind that in Romans 4, mm-hmm. dealing with the English judiciary to just refute or have the potential to do so, that is already an interpretation of the position.
I see, yeah. But it is. Bringing it into disrepute has a different connotation for me almost. It's almost as if, like, somebody goes, as we've had before, no names being used, but where you have a judge who does an arbitration, is given trust monies, and then suddenly there's a problem with the trust money, that brings the judiciary into disrepute. But the construct of the reputation of the judiciary is a broader issue. It involves skill. It involves competence. A degree of confidence in the person's ability, almost. So for me, it's a different kettle of fish, almost. And I think image or the reputation of the administration of justice. We do it this way. It adversely affects the image or reputation of judges. Or the administration of justice in the Republic. Judges as opposed to the judiciary. Should we even go further and say judicial officers?
Judges,
because we're dealing with the JST at the moment. And then the administration of justice would cover everything else in any case. A magistrate or... Because remember, you're now going to be dealing with regional courts who have civil jurisdiction as well. Take out judges. Just say administration of justice. Because then you...
there's an argument to say that if you say judges or the administration of justice, that you're only limiting it to your high court sentence.
If you say
judiciary,
then you tell
it. Except that Mr. DeLange points out that it could be read as one and the same thing, with, as I explained, I think this one here has got a different spin to it, in the sense that it deals with your competence and your skill and your confidence of having your ability. Whereas bringing the judiciary into disrepute is like when somebody does wrong and is a judge, that kind of taints everybody by association, as opposed to speaking to your skill and your capacity. So if it brings the justice system into disrepute, that maybe has that broader connotation that I'm talking about.
These are still guidelines.
Correct. You have room to maneuver. In other words, the minister can issue other criteria as well to clarify some of these things. And so I just thought it was important to have these criteria set out in legislation, because clearly these are your big concerns that you would have as legislature. If you bring your judiciary into disrepute, or you have the potential to do so, that should immediately concern the member of the executive entrusted to apply discretion to some of these applications and guide them. And I think it's important that we express some of those in legislation as opposed to merely in regulations. But they, in any case, going to divide with the Chief Justice. That may not capture some of these concerns that we have, which are more overarching. Anybody else on any of the other criteria? Can we move on? Okay, then Mr. DeLange, a small thing on the matter of the of sub 4, it's just a turn of phrase. I would much prefer it to read as follows. The minister must cause the registrar of judges' registrable interests referred to, I don't like that phrase, but okay, judges' registrable interests sounds like a bit of a mouthful. But okay, let's leave it for now, because they obviously we're going to get to that part of it as well. Referred to in section 13.1, to receive all instances where written consent as contemplated is granted. To be informed of, as opposed to receive. So the minister must cause the registrar to be informed of. All instances where written consent is contemplated.
Isn't the intention that you should keep a register?
Yeah.
So why does he say it?
We are in the register clause. Yeah. There is a whole clause on the register of judges, the register of all interests.
These applications must form part of the register.
I'm being distracted by JJ's hair. It shines. I want shiny hair.
No,
I think it's the light. It's just reflecting nice. Sparkle. It's a halo. Where ESCOM is failing, JB takes over. Somebody said to me, yes, this is really tough. Take over public enterprises at Christmas and camp. Okay, so we are happy with section 11 then? The minister must every 12 months table in Parliament. Oh, sorry? Yes? Where?
to be informed of all what?
The minister must cause the registrar of judges register interest referred to in section 13(1) to be informed of all instances where written consent is granted. Is that how it says? Written consent is all instances where written consent is not granted. Where written consent has been granted. Where written consent has been granted. Or is. Yeah. It's not the instances where written consent has been granted. That is clear as mud. Okay. The last clause there, the minister must once every 12 months table a report in Parliament containing particulars including the outcome of every application made in terms of subsection 1 or 2, especially in respect of each application granted and any conditions attached later during the period covered by the report. I would imagine, because it's particulars, it's containing particulars, including the outcome. Now look, this wasn't there before. This is a new insertion. And I'm not so sure that it's entirely required anymore, because you've now got the registrar who's going to be given all of that information anyway, which should be available to the public. But I think this is more of a kind of accountability instrument, almost, to say that a report must be tabled. The one aspect that we must consider is whether we want, in the way that it's phrased, every application, whether granted or not, must form part of the report. The question is that entirely necessary?
I think it's also necessary to know who did not receive permission. Now, if you look at the JSC report, you never see who failed to be appointed to judge. You only see the names of those who eventually were successful. But they never put up with. And I think it's important to know that so and so was considered.
Okay. So that's the view.
So, in respect of each application, refuse or grant?
No, it just says the outcome of every application. So, the outcome would be either way. Yeah? Okay, let's go through the code as well, which is the other substantive issue, Mr. Delanga.
One issue, and I don't want to be overly technically, but I'm a bit worried, especially from how you're going to interpret this. If you read the month report particulars, including the outcome, and then expression, what does especially signify in this instance? Is the second part is going to be more comprehensive, more particular, but clearly this is an indication that the legislature is drawing a distinction. So the one will be different to the other, and I'm not too sure whether that is exactly what you really have in mind.
I think you're correct. I mean, you could just say the outcome of every application and any conditions attached thereto.
Even if we just say including any conditions
attached to those grants.
Yeah,
something like
that.
No, I think that's fine.
That wouldn't come out. It won't make any difference.
Yeah. So we'll leave that to you, Mr. Delange. You can sort that out for us, okay? code of conduct?
See, yes, the code of, I think there weren't many changes here. Basically just being tied up that the code must be tabled to the National Assembly, not the Parliament. It must actually be approved by the National Assembly. It must be tabled in the National Assembly. The National Assembly can amend changes to the code or to any amendment tabled to it, only after obtaining and considering public comment on that procedure. And then there's a deadlock breaking mechanism being proposed, in the sense that I'm looking at sub 2 there.
I was hoping Mr. Magonishu would be smiling, but he's just now left.
That is the first code. The first code must be tabled within 4 months after the commencement of this Act, but if consensus could not be achieved between the Minister and the Chief Justice, that would be, then both versions of the code must be tabled in the National Assembly within the same period. And yes, that is really all that is needed.
If we have two versions, which one is the one that
But there you see, in sub 3 is where the crux of the thing happens. It was regardless. Look, the principle was that we in the National Assembly were going to approve the code with or without amendments after public hearing. Now, whether it's the one code that they both agree on, clearly it will have some effect once it comes to Parliament, and Parliament would take into cognizance that both the Chief Justice and the Minister of Justice have approved this code. And so you'll be a little circumspect about some of the things that you would want to change and so on. But where there isn't consensus, you recall our discussion, Mr. Magwanishi particularly was worried about putting deadlines to a code being tabled, and then you have disagreements between the Minister and the Chief Justice which may delay things. This is meant to be a deadlock breaking mechanism in that sense, to say, look, if they can't agree, then let them both table their version before Parliament. Let us then pursue it, and then clearly the message is, look, there is some disagreement on this matter. Parliament needs to look particularly at the issues in dispute and so on, and finally decide on what the outcome will be after, of course, public hearings and having considered the matter, which I think is a far more amicable way of dealing with the difficulties that may or may not arise, which also doesn't hamstring the two individuals who are dealing with this matter, in the sense that they have to come to some kind of compromise before they come to Parliament. All this is saying is that your views can then be brought forward to Parliament, and Parliament in any case will make a decision, and this is allowing, I think, a freer exchange of information than ordinarily would be the case, because in a situation where you force them to agree, their compromise is made. And those compromises may not necessarily be something that Parliament will necessarily want to agree to, or something of that sort. So I think this is a better way of dealing with the issue. But the principle has always been that Parliament will, I mean, certainly that's been the committee's view from the beginning, that we will ultimately decide and legislate on the code of conduct.
I fully agree with that, but we have to keep in mind that there is an existing code. It's maybe informal, it's not. So I don't think there will be big issues after that.
It's not a code, Mr.
It's
a code of ethics, which is completely different from a code of conduct. Code of ethics is almost a guide, kind of rules, be good children, we love you. Remember, you love each other. Remember to love each other.
Okay.
And this one is, you have been naughty, I'll clap you. Eat your bees. Use your walk. You know, don't stab your brother with a knife.
Stab him with a fork, not with a knife.
Don't throw your peas out of your pot. Okay.
Maybe raise one other issue, which is really also technical in the matter of drop off. So I apologize if you've mentioned earlier, or maybe we've mentioned it before, that it might be problematic. If you read the must compile, I'm looking at 12.1, must compile a code of judicial conduct which must be tabled. Now, I know that the singular can also mean the plural, but I do not think it is really intended that there is more than one code. And then it might be a bit confusing to read in two. The minister must table the first code. Are there other things to follow? Shouldn't we simply say the minister must table the code in Parliament within 4 months? And all other things will be amendments, and it will be revised from time to time, but it will still be the code. There won't be more than one code at any stage, I'm sure.
That's fine. I don't think there's a problem with interpretation. Emma?
Can you talk about, for example, the difference between the minister and the chief justice? And two versions of the article, the code of conduct, or Parliament, or National Assembly. And we are saying that the National Assembly has then the power to reject, you know, change the code of conduct, or whatever. Do we have to take that in the legislation as to how we're going to do it? Now, this is the National Assembly. How do we get an outcome?
You're saying that there's always a process of public comment and there's always a process of deliberation. But you know, it's very interesting, Emma. Not many people know this. I mean, it's been quite interesting. I actually had a chat to PMG about this matter at some stage to say, you know, it seems that people think that when they make submissions to us, we can just file it and not look at it. And people were very concerned when we were dealing with these bills initially. I got the letters to say, and interestingly, from people who should know better, that you know, when will our submission be considered? Why are you not considering our submission? And it almost seemed as if there's some sense that Parliament can ignore people's submission, and Parliament will, as a matter of course, do so and so on. And I think this is more than a laying of those kinds of fears. That clearly when it comes to issues like the Code of Conduct, look, I mean, there is a rule that says Parliament can determine its own procedure. But clearly with the recent court cases, something as important as, you know, we often do it with the regulations, for example, that comes or we do that sometimes when it comes to things where, for example, this is tabled, and not necessarily for consideration and report. We do, for example, not deal with public hearings. Sometimes when they finalize rules on certain things and they bring it to us, we don't necessarily call for public submissions, but if we get them, we distribute and we discuss them. So that's really how Parliament works. And more times we call for public submissions than not. Most of our work we do. Given that the Code of Conduct in any case is going to be of legislative status, clearly all laws we follow that procedure. There isn't a single law, even if it's technical, as the Constitutional Court ruled that, you know, when it's technical stuff, you may not necessarily ask for comments and to engage the public and stuff. But in this committee, we always do. There may be times when you don't get submissions, in which case if you don't get submissions, then clearly you don't get submissions. But more often than not, we do, and I think this is just to allay certain fears.
The obligation is to consider them, not necessarily to interest.
Exactly, and to consider them for what they're worth in terms of their substance. I can't speak for other committees, but I know in this committee we always do that. We always go through those submissions and we go through it clause by clause, then the summaries of it as it pertains to the recommendations in the clauses. And I don't have to explain to you guys how intensively we deal with those questions. So. Emma?
Yes.
Question is,
if you how does the national assembly affect the question? Do they establish an ethical policy with the matter? We see them, we don't say anything.
No, but that you don't need to say. The National Assembly, look, when any legislation comes to Parliament, it's the committee process. When we say the National Assembly approves legislation, it's obviously channeled through a committee, and the committee then... No, we don't have to say that, Emma. To the best of my knowledge, there isn't a process whereby a bill can come to Parliament and it just gets tabled in the House and passed in the House. It has to be channeled through a committee, even if it is an ad hoc committee. That will always be. Okay?
Chief, I maybe take the committee back about 5 or 6 meetings in the past when you first started discussing this issue of public comment. You must remember that the whole of C1 in the poll that was submitted earlier in the year used to say that it must be submitted to Parliament, then the committee started that it must be approved by Parliament, it must be tabled, not only submitted, it must be approved. Then the question arose, okay, but does the committee have a choice? Can it change the bill? Must it either approve or disapprove it? And then we said, okay, no, it must be able to change. And then the committee felt at the time that this is really the only instance. We must remember this big, I should maybe not call it debate, but it's one of the issues about the drafting codes of conduct for the judiciary, referring to other conventions and international precedent. Then it was decided that you will follow this route of the judiciary drafting the code by Parliament approving. But Parliament have that ability or the power to change it, and that is really the only instance where the public, it's about accountability, where the public will have some say into what they expect of their judicial officers, and therefore the committee felt quite important to take in here.
It goes to the very heart of Section 1, which says there will be openness in government. So that you don't have closed door negotiations between the minister and the chief justice, and suddenly that's your code of conduct. You actually have an opportunity through Parliament, and that's a very good thing that you pointed that out, Mr. Delon. We forgot some of those discussions. It's because I'm worried about Christmas. Okay. So. Emma?
No.
Okay. Good. Anything under 4 and 5? Okay.
We didn't need for actually
finding
what we mean
about the media
standard.
Where are you, Mr. Randall?
Sorry.
I'm 12. Sub 5? Okay. Just check your definitions while you're at it. There are two definitions, not just at the beginning of the bill. There's one before chapter 2, or 3, 2, Mr. Bernardo. Okay, let's then, are we happy with the code of conduct clauses now? Okay, can we move on to the registrable interest stuff?
Very well, Chair. The first change of notice is the heading. Members will see in the previous document it used to be Register of Chartered Financial Interest. It's been thought that is rather narrow. The interest, financial interest, is rather restricting and was decided to change it to disclosure of registrable interest. Registrable interest being defined. Then one is new, which is not completely new, it's been changed a bit. It says the minister must appoint a senior official in the Office of the Chief Justice as the registrar of judges' registrable interest. In other words, there will be a designated person that is solely tasked with this responsibility, and it is in position. We've discussed it within the department. It will be a fairly senior person as well. Then, two, the registrar must open and keep the register called the Register of Judges' Registrable Interest. And this is especially designed for those Afrikaans speaking people who write, who cannot say R. And they might even say R. The registrar must record in the register particulars of judges' registrable interests, amend any entries in the register when necessary, and perform other duties in connection with the register as required in terms of the Act. Every judge must disclose to the register, and members will recall we felt that there was a lacuna here in that this whole Act of Disclosure was not specifically defined, now it's specifically stated. Every judge must disclose to the registrar in the prescribed form particulars of all his or her registrable interests and those of his or her immediate family members. Immediate family members, of course, being defined, I think you will want to return to the definition as well. The minister acting in consultation with the chief justice must make regulations. This provision is relatively the same as it used to be. See, there is new the manner and the instances in which and the time limits within which registrable assets. Registrable interests must be disclosed to the registrar, then the confidential and public part again, and the interests to be recorded in that part respectively. The recording in the public part of the register of all registrable interests derived from the application of section 11, the direct cross-reference there to 11. And sub 6 there. The regulations may determine different criteria for judges in active service and judges who have been discharged from active service or judges in acting capacity, including in respect of matters referred to in subsection 5G. Then 7, the minister must table the first regulations under this section in Parliament for approval within 4 months of the commencement of the Act, provided that there is no consensus. Both versions of the regulations must be tabled in Parliament within the same period. And then we have a similar provision to what we have with the Code of Conduct. The Parliament can obtain public comment and then change the regulations in Parliament. So maybe we should, while we have it very briefly, turn to page 8 and look at, I think there was quite a comprehensive discussion that one of the former presidents using. The definition of immediate family member there, it says in relation to a judge, refers to the page 6 is the new 7G, 71G. Immediate family member refers to the spouse, civil partner, or permanent life partner of that judge, and includes dependent children of and family members living in the same household with the judge.
Anybody has a problem with the definition? Because that's really part of our discussions that we had the last time, and we've amended it accordingly, Mr. Landis.
Yeah, I concede, Chair, that I may not be in that definition, so I wonder whether we should be putting it in that
it becomes a bit of a difficulty for me, I must say. I'll tell you why. One of the things that we had thought about initially was whether, for example, even children should be included. And we then compromised and said we should include dependent children. Okay, so it's not children who are out of the house and self-supporting and so on. Likewise, I would imagine siblings would be captured if they were people, family members living in the same household.
but not necessarily people who have their own lives and their own sons. I think it kind of tends to go a bit broad. Remember also parents, which is also your one degree. I mean, your brothers and your sisters one degree this way, your parents are one degree this way. They're also included in as only under the overall umbrella of family members living in the same household. So it's only parents who are again dependent. We came back to the issue of dependence the whole time. I think also you, Mr. DeLange, you guys did that exercise to see internationally what was, there's a whole study, Mr. Landers, that you might want to look at that they've done about other jurisdictions and what they require in terms of immediate family member and the interest there to be recorded and so on. I don't think that they came across the issue of siblings, because I do think it tends to become a problem. You have to, unfortunately, you have to. What happens with the members of parliament, though, Mr. Landers? So that the siblings included there? I can't remember. Is it only spouse? Is there immediate family members? No, no, no. I'm just checking. I thought maybe you're raising it because it may be. I think we've got a bit of a balancing act to do, and I think we've gone as far as we possibly can on the extension of family members. I can't see that you can go broader without coming to this far too. Anybody else on the matter of immediate family members? Mrs. McFlower, how are you?
Hi.
You're looking very serious and you're not smiling at me. What is that? I just I like the word meditating. Next time somebody says, so and so was asleep in the house, I'll just say they were meditating. Very serious. Now, okay. When it comes to the actual clause, anybody want to raise anything about the clause itself? Let's start from the beginning. The issue of the appointment of a register of registrable interest. I think that's correct that it's placed in the office of the Chief Justice. I think it must be a senior official. And I think that what that will do is, remember previously they had this person reporting via the Executive Secretary. And that becomes a problem when you're talking about somebody of the caliber of a registrar who must then be able to complain without having to report to another official to do so, to seek permission and so on. So the only person that this person is ultimately accountable to would be the Chief Justice himself. I think that we've got that now right. Then the registrar keeps a register called the Register of Judges Registrable Interest and must record in the register particulars of judges registrable interest. Mend any entries in the register when necessary and perform the other duties in connection with the register as required in terms of the task. So that one there is reasonably clear. Every judge must disclose to the register in the prescribed form particulars of all his or her registrable interests in and those of his or her immediate family members. The first disclosure in terms of sub 3 must be within 60 days of a date fixed by the president by proclamation thereafter annually, and in such instances as prescribed.
Okay, what about a new appointment? Does he have a whole year to what I have in years to do it, or have I received 16 or 18?
I guess that will be covered in the regulation, because we make provision for the time period within which people have to register. Mr. Delanda?
Yeah, that's what the such instances as prescribed in the convention.
Correct.
Sure. So definitely be annually, that will be the basis minimum, but then there will be prescribed for the holiday flat now or the cruise liner now.
They could afford those things on their salary, don't they?
Go on cruise, buy the cruise line.
Could buy your fleet of ships with that salary. Okay. What I did want to find out from you, Mr. DeLange, is the 60 days now fixed by the President. As I understand it, within 4 months of the Act, you've got to have the regulations in place. Then you have, I imagine, at the same time or somewhere in between the 4 months, you're going to have the registrar appointed. You then have the regulations, you then have the registrar. I can't see that it will take longer than that time to appoint such people. Then you give 60 days to the President to fix the disclosure by proclamation.
For example, say I proclaim 1 July 2008 as the date of the subsection, then our judges will have 60 days from the 1st of July 2008. Those 60 days they must comply. The President can determine in advance, I want to set this down as a date, and then you'll have 60 days from that date.
That's the
idea. Mm. You can, of course, do it after the 4 months.
Yeah, no, there's nothing there.
There's nothing there to stop that. Okay, no, I was reading it wrongly, actually. Thought the 60 days, what the President has thereafter, that's wrong. So within 60 days of the date, so they have, once the President fixes the 1st of July, they have 60 days with which to comply. And if they fail to comply within that period, like us, Mr. Landis, isn't that so? There's a period that you have to comply.
Yes.
And if you fail to comply within that period, then you failed to comply, basically, and then you...
What happens
then? Then the registrar, in terms of this, well, we'll get there, the registrar will lay a complaint. It's a formal disciplinary complaint. So, but we'll get there. Okay, then... Let's go to the next one. Acting, the Minister acting in consultation with the Chief Justice must make regulations regarding the content and management of the register referred to in sub 2, which regulations must at least prescribe the format of the register, the kinds of interests of judges and their immediate family members that are regarded as registrable interests. I think that's right, Member. The manner and the instances in which and the time limits within which registrable interests must be disclosed to the registrar, a confidential public part of the register and the interests to be recorded in those parts respectively, the recording in the public part of the register of all registrable interests derived from the application of Section 11, all of that sorted out. Then a procedure providing for public access to the public part of the register, and this is new, a procedure for providing access to and maintaining confidentiality of the confidential part of the register, and the lodging of a complaint in terms of 14(1) by the registrar in the event of failure to register any registrable interest by any judge, including any failure to register any such interest within a prescribed time limit, or disclosure of false or misleading information by any judge. Those are the kinds of things that you can complain. Okay?
two things together. We provided under G the logic of the complaint by the registrar. Not to whom,
no, it will be to the Judicial Complaints Committee, which is also in this legislation. It's just a pretty, you know what it is, we're dealing with these matters now as amendments because they're substantive issues. But we'll go through the rest of the bill just now as well, and you'll see there that you have the Judicial Complaints
Committee. But that's just a
in terms of 14.1, you'll see it in
14.1. Alright, alright. And then the process, is that also further on in the book?
Which process?
Well, once
the process of a complaint. Yes.
Then the register table is
a complaint. Yes. This all is about
it
that procedure. Yeah, it's a complaint procedure, in other words.
Do you think a member of the public, J.D. Simagnoni, that member of the public, according to this, what happens, and he or she then goes to the registry?
Well, imagine that that would always be possible. Or, 41 is just at the bottom of that page there. You see, any person may lodge a complaint about the judge with the chairperson of the committee. So that's always possible. Or the person could just, you know, it may just be something that you would want to draw the registrar's interest to or something, or attention to. But any person can lay a complaint about the judge. Okay? Okay. So that one, then 6, the regulations may determine different criteria for judges in active service and those who have been discharged from active service, or judges acting in an acting, or judges in an acting capacity, including in respect of matters referred to in 5D. Now remember, this story here is quite complicated because what you have there is you have judges who are acting who may still have other interests and so on, but what you want to do is you want to bring them into the fold of disclosure while they are acting on the bench, and that's why we include those categories as well. Okay?
Well, we shouldn't have them in acting capacity.
Don't disagree. Minister must table the first regulations under this section in Parliament for approval within 4 months of the commencement of this Act, provided that if consensus could not be achieved as contemplated in sub 5, both versions of the regulations must be tabled in Parliament within the said period. When the regulations or any amendment thereto is submitted to Parliament, Parliament may, after obtaining and considering public comment thereon, approve the regulations or such amendments without any changes thereto, or with such changes thereto as may be effected by Parliament. And this is, look, Mr. DeLonge can say why it's Parliament and not the National Assembly, but I don't think that this is necessarily about the complaints mechanism. This is about the register, which is a mechanism to ensure a degree of transparency, if you're with me. So I can't see why it should be the National Assembly. Remember, the issue of the code of conduct, that's a different issue because it pertains to a disciplinary or complaints type of thing. There, the NCOP doesn't really play too much of a role as far as removing judges are concerned, for example. We had this discussion. There is a possibility, of course, that there are disagreements between the NCOP and the NA, but then you have a deadlock-breaking mechanism that can be put into place. So,
I just delayed the matter. The National Assembly is
That's also true. Wouldn't you like all those to speak out tonight? Yeah. Okay. Anybody want to raise anything on those ones? Okay. Let's go to the front of the building. We've dealt with some of the substantive issues. Is there another substantive issue that we need to
deal with? So, just on this clause 8 again, so the committee sort of made a decision about Parliament or the National Assembly.
Why don't you tell us?
The problem I foresee
is we don't want to say to our national and our NTOP counterparts that we want to exclude them. We want you to say.
No, but there is a possible problem in the inconsistency. I hear, of course, everything you're saying about the kind of conduct and the difference in nation. But the bigger problem is really, if you deal with legislation, you've got the formal setting up, get 75-76 legislation. Constitutional, there are rules, even the constitution spells out what the powers of each house be, are. But I'm not aware of any rules in this parliament where you can look at secondary legislation. You don't have any mechanisms in the event that there's a difference of opinion between the two houses, which might really cause a very potential delay.
And this would be regulation. Not like this. What is the code of conduct wouldn't be a regulation.
Well, it will have the force of law. So it boils down to the same thing. It boils down to being secondary legislation. That's the one issue I just want to briefly raise here. The other one is, it's just a suggestion. It says, and I'm looking at 7 now, I must table the first regulation under the session in Parliament with full approval within 4 months of the commencement of the Act. I think we've seen in practice that legislation such as this, which will require quite a bit of preparatory work and secondary legislation being drafted, you may delay the commencement of the Act for an ordinary period of time pending the finalisation of all these other matters. If we change this Act to this section, it would, for example, be possible to put all the disciplinary mechanisms and all those processes to commence with those provisions without having to wait for everything to be ready before you put those clauses into operation.
But then you'll have to have a special commencement of the section in the commencement clause.
Yeah, but although maybe I'm wrong, you can actually put the rest of the Act into operation and keep this one back. You can do that. In fact, that maybe it's not really a problem.
Well, there is also precedent where you would put some clauses into operation and not others.
Yes,
and this could come into operation and then...
On a legislation. Yes. This is definitely one of those pieces of legislation that I often will not commence from day.
Let's put this section in this thing.
Well.
And then that way you guys can decide whether you want that section to be one of those sections that come into effect immediately and not held back. And we go for National Assembly. Members? Your proposal. You'll go and speak to your NTOP colleagues about it.
The upper house.
The upper house. Will you speak to the upper house about it, please?
Sure.
No, look, it is a big problem. It is a big problem. It's one of the things that could potentially delay things. And I think it is worth explaining to them that the issue is not really a issue. It's more a question of procedure. As Mr. DeLange points out, this is subordinate legislation, and there isn't a procedure at the moment in the rules for a deadlock breaking mechanism on subordinate legislation. So if they come with a different view, this could stall the implementation, is really what they're concerned about. Nothing stops us conferring, of course, as the two committees and so on. And I think that, I mean, we've done that before, and particularly when it comes to issues of discipline and so on with the magistracy, we confer with him when we do our briefings and so on. And we're going to take separate decisions, but we know that ultimately our view, we know what each other's views are, and that's a control mechanism. But there would be a problem if, on a disciplinary matter, for example, they took a different view from us. There's no deadline for it.
Correct.
that's how I would propose we deal with it. And you can, if you would be so kind as to go in, speak to your colleagues, you'll do the same on our side. Okay, Mr. Delanga.
Thank you.
NA, and then you say, must table this within 4 months of the commencement of the petition. Okay, anybody else? Anything further? Can we go back to the first part of the... We'll start now from the beginning. I just wanted to deal with the substantive issues so that Mr. Yubaro needs to leave this now and take those things away. Sure, Mr. Lange.
That is the question. When does the judge who is just in the court, how much time is he or she given?
That will be regulated. And that's why the regulations are going to come back to you. Okay? All right, let's go to page 2. The changes on page 1. Deleted as introduced, the format is not bold. Okay. Page 2.
The other thing that's important on page 1 is that it should, in brackets, as presented by the portfolio committee, after consideration of the judicial office amendment bill B72 of 2001, that is rather important.
That judicial office's bill is still technically with us, having been revived and so on. But we'll, once we pass this, that law will fall away because this is a committee bill arising from that. We were unhappy about the provisions in that bill, and we're not presenting this. Okay? All right, Mr.
DeLong,
page 2.
I think I don't need to go through the amendments of the long title, which I think they speak for themselves.
Okay. Members, just look at that stuff. I think it's just a long title. It's really just making it a little more comprehensive in the sense that it gives you, in a nutshell, the things that the bill deals with. Preamble likewise.
Yes.
We've got a change at the bottom there, the second last paragraph.
Yes, that is new change, just a reference to 177.3, which of course refers to the possibility of the president suspending the judge on the advice of the Judicial Service Commission, who is the subject of the procedure in terms of 177.1. That is, of course, judge suffering from capacity crisis, incompetence or gross misconduct, and the natural essential cause for that judge to be removed. Just interesting in this regard, I think we've got no, the only way that we can interpret the phrase subject of the procedure in terms of 177.1. Just a paragraph proceeding is quoting 177.1, so I think one must come to the necessary conclusion that procedure means anything that is connected with the application of those provisions. I cannot find any other.
In any case, it doesn't make any sense to suspend somebody once they're found guilty of those.
No. Okay. Then the last, whereas. That's really just a technical. We've added one bullet there. Complaints against judges could be lodged and dealt with appropriately. Just maybe also to explain here. These small amplifications of the preamble were necessitated as a result of the fact that members will recall you had two bills at one stage, the Judicial Service Commission Amendment Bill and the Justice Judicial Tribunal Bill. Now, the Tribunal Bill used to have a preamble, but the Service Commission one not. Then the two bills were collapsed and we carried out over the preamble from the Tribunal Bill to this one. But as a result, the preamble was rather limited in scope. Was more referring to the tribunals, and I would just have to add all the other provisions as well to make it a bit more comprehensive.
The JSC Act as it stands now have a substantive preamble?
No,
or
it
not?
Doesn't have one at all, Chief. No, not at all.
Chief, just a small matter. In the Judicial Education Bill, we changed the format in the preamble to Simpson, not whereas. It's not an issue I can live with.
Maybe I should comment on that in commonly that
when do you use sin?
When I started to use sin, I just said we've done sin.
No, look, it's irrelevant to me. I mean, if Mr. DeLong is happy, he's the one that takes pride in his craftsmanship. I'm not. I am since the strike back. Where is the and whereas I am the chair, we will use this. Okay. Whatever. Whatever. Chapter 1, Mr. DeLonga. Any changes with added respondent?
No, that is really an old message. Okay. I must just explain to members as well for the sake of its eligibility. The changes being indicated in this draft are not only the changes that we've detected since our last discussion and last committee meeting.
Okay.
The document really, you remember when we started dealing with the bill that was referred back to the committee by the minister, all the changes from there is reflected in this.
So we're not going to go through all of those changes. You're just going to take us through the changes since our last discussion. Is that right? Okay. But what this draft does, members, is every single change that we've ever affected to the soul will be here. Okay. All right. So in your hands, Mr. DeLonga, you take us through which one?
Now, one is really unchanged. In two, we've made a very small change. I think we covered it at the last meeting, but let's just for clarity go through it again. There's an sub 2 is neither the Chief Justice nor the Deputy Chief Justice is available to preside at a meeting of the Commission. It used to be neither the Chairperson nor Acting Chairperson, and I think quite correctly the Committee thought it's much, much more appropriate to say that neither the Chief Justice or the Deputy Chief Justice is available. The amendment is certainly in the clause in section 3, that is clause 5 on the bottom of page 4, that is old news, and we've covered that quite comprehensively. As is 6 and 7, although the words in clause 7, that is section 5, publication of procedure of commission, there were words inserted there, including subsequent amendments. Ex abundante cautela, was thought that would serve some purpose. I don't think it really changed anything.
I want to check something.
Should we move on to 8?
Eight
deals with section 6 of the Act at the moment. If you put a report, the annual report by the Commission, amendment 6.1. The committee discussed that previously. It must be a written report. Well, that is just a matter of drafting improvement. And then for tabling, the committee felt strongly that the tabling must be specifically included there. Then 2 was elaborated somewhat to make sure that the report must include information regarding all the activities of the commission.
You've just lost me a bit, Mr. DeLonga. Where are you exactly?
I'm at the bottom of page 5, Chair.
Okay, hang on. Some of us are not used to working on a Tuesday.
Okay.
No, not necessarily. And
if
there's no work, why must you find work?
Some people
spoil easy. It's called being rewarded for hard work.
One should move up, not
sideways. Hey, this is called moving up. Except when you're on a plane. But okay, that's sorry, Mr. DeLonga.
Yeah, the only noteworthy change, I think, in section 6 is that C, the new C being inserted, says that the report of the Commission must now include all matters relating to, including the degree of compliance with the Register of Judges' Registrable Interest, as reported by the Registrar, and duly all matters considered by the Commission in accordance with the application of Chapter 2 and 3 of the Act, including the number of matters outstanding and the progress in respect thereof.
Wonderful. That's exactly and precisely what we want to do. Members happy? Okay, let's move on.
Here the next issue is the new Section 7, I'm on page 6. We've already covered the definition of immediate family member. I'm just to take it if we see head of court, the definition of head of court, in relation to a complaint against the judge of the Constitutional Court, the Chief Justice of the SCA, the President of the SCA, and of any other court in the JP of the court. Then 4 and 5 is new. 4, who are performing judicial duties in an acting capacity on the day the complaint arose, means the head of court in which such judge acted when the complaint arose. 4, 5, who has been discharged from active service, means the Chief Justice. I think that is
now
quite
that was
important
an important point. This is a bit of an important oversight on our part.
Well, not necessarily. The only possible, actually, it's not, you're not very clear. Because I think it only comes into play if the chairperson of the committee can delegate in a very limited kind of things to the so-called head of court. But if it's an act, if it's a judge, the social active service, he cannot be in the head of court.
But also it comes into play when you deal with appointments of members and stuff like that.
No, then it can become.
But the truth of the matter is we didn't have a head of court for judges who were discharged. I imagine that you would be your previous one.
Their contention that they're not really
exactly.
It shouldn't have and the or.
Mr. DeLonga?
Yeah, I think that's correct. Yeah, I think that's correct. Well, it's actually, this is one of those things where it really does
doesn't
not
matter.
Matter.
Yeah,
but
doesn't
not
matter. Matter.
Yeah, because when you read it, you read all you
we may not be able to see well, but we can hear well.
Some of us.
Some of us. Okay, next.
That's all we shall do within the definition of torture.
No, there
the
is
judge,
something else here, Mr. DeLonga, and the judge, yeah.
Yes, there's a reference to a judge who has been discharged from active service in terms of that act. This is probably also, I think, in abundance of caution, because there some do argue that judge doesn't necessarily mean a judge discharged from active service, and this will erase any doubt.
This will erase any doubt that as far as this committee is concerned, judges for life. Okay?
And then it also relates to
and
judges in an acting capacity with the exception of course.
Okay, I think that's now far more comprehensive and deals with all of those possible, shall we say, less than perfect interpretations who is judge, and more particularly, who is not.
Then the next clause, clause 8, deals with the establishment and composition of the Judicial Conduct Committee. Only change of some significance here is the addition of that sub 6, which says that any vacancy which may arise in respect of a designation in terms of subsection 1C must immediately be filled for the remaining period of such designation in the manner prescribed in this section.
Did we also have the four judges, at least two of them must be women before?
Yeah, that was the...
We've already discussed that one. Okay. And the limited tenure with the so it's just the vacancy that must be immediately filled for the remaining period of the designation. I think that gives clarity. Okay? Next, Mr. DeLonga.
Okay, then 9 is dealing with meetings of the committee. I think this was redrafted to a very limited extent, but the committee did discuss this issue fairly extensively. It deals with the quorums, etc. I'm referring to sub 2, B, and C in the event of inequality of those being cast by the committee and then declaring that the meeting. The the person presiding at the meeting and the deciding vote in addition to his or her deliberate vote, and see the minister must by notice in the Gazette make known the particulars of the procedure, including subsequent amendments which the committee has determined in terms of subsection 2A. That is fairly similar to what the JSC must do in terms of the existing act regarding the appointment of judges and the procedure to be adopted at its meeting dealing with appointment of judges. Chair?
This is the super committee, Mr. Dananda, and my feeling on the issue of sub C is that it becomes a little too straight-jacketed, I think, for this committee to be bound by absolute procedures. And remember, this is a mechanism that receives the complaint. Decides, is it a, what do we say? Is it a rare medium soft complaint? If it's a rare one, then you have the informal thing of referring it to the head of court, and they can just deal with it either in terms of an apology or whatever, or they could dismiss it. Then reasons for the dismissal must be channeled through the chairperson. If it's a medium to rare kind of complaint, then a certain procedure. If it's a hard complaint, then another procedure. I'm just worried that if you were to formalize the procedure in the sense that you're going to actually stipulate this much and that much, it's going to make it a far more bureaucratic, and people are going to raise issues with the procedure rather than substance of the issues, particularly when it's your very small little complaint. And you're not going to get resolution in my lifetime to any complaint here. So what I think you must do on that one there, at this stage, put it, still keep it as an option, but put it as an option one. Let's see. And then when we finally vote on this matter, we can, I think parties must consider. Remember, this is not the tribunal. The tribunal is the one where you want set procedures because somebody can be dismissed. This is meant to be a flexible.
Okay, that's the only thing there, Chair. Then we get to part two, the judicial conduct part. In source 10, or the new section 10, we just added the word R. I think this was done previously in any event, but let's just go through very quickly. Again, the object of the committee to receive, consider, and deal with complaints in terms of part 3. Formally, it used to say consider complaints.
Sorry, where are you now, Mr. Delano?
Right at the top of page 8, yes.
Please, can I take you back to 9?
Please take me back to 9 because that's where I was, Mr. Yabish.
Not clear to me. We say the committee may determine the procedure to be followed at this meeting, but is the one that has to be gazetted C, is that the procedure when it deals with a complaint?
Yeah, basically, it will only meet if there's a complaint.
Yeah.
And what? Remember, this is your sitting mechanism. So if the you know, my worry is, Mr. Yabaz, is that you set out a procedure in the beginning, and even a small thing becomes an issue of big contestation. What I would prefer this structure to be is a flexible structure. So when it comes to meeting, for example, you receive a complaint, why can't you just pick up the phone and say, can we just meet over lunch? At whatever venue, which is receiving the complaint, rather than, for example, issuing out notice, making sure somebody's receiving, you know, that, those kinds of things. Do we need that kind of set?
Seeing at the level of these people normally work, I mean, you can take it that they will follow proper procedure.
Exactly.
So I think we can leave it to say that they determine it.
And well, that's precisely why that clause is there.
And that's why I'm saying put C now as an option. We can decide when we finally vote whether we're going to want to keep that in or not. Parties, I think, must go and consider that issue. Okay? Okay,
maybe if I can just add one aspect there. I think you should also bear in mind that when it comes to committee meetings, the Act actually sets out very comprehensively what happens in those meetings. Some might argue it's too detailed, in fact, but it does have a very clear indication of
it. And over and above that, you have regulated procedures and gazetted procedures, which in any case may take time. I mean, that's the other issue. In terms of implementation of this legislation, may also take more time than it may. And I don't know that it's strictly speaking here.
And just more in a mischievous sense, Chair. This provision comes from Section 6, or rather, the existing Section 6, 178.6 of the Constitution. It says that JSC may determine its own procedure. But decisions of the Commission must be supported by a majority of its members. Then, the former Portfolio Committee back in 1995, then, in relation to this provision, actually added what we have now and say the Commission must publish in the Gazette the decisions of the procedure. But there might be an argument that's stupid for contradiction in the Constitution because you can determine your own procedure. Difficult to say that you must publish this procedure because you're not owner. How can you, if you publish a procedure, it means you're bound to that and then you cannot determine the procedure, but that's not that solution.
Well, if you publish your procedure, you see, I do think that there's a balancing act in some instances. My feeling is that certainly when it comes to the tribunal, for example, which is really the body seized with making a final, almost final recommendation to the JSC on the matter of whether somebody should be impeached or not, then you want to veer towards a more formalized procedure and a more certain procedure and so on and so on. Likewise with the JSC, I think that while it can determine its own procedure, I think that there is an element of openness and transparency that applies to that body as well. This structure is conceived, as I say, as a sifting mechanism more than anything else. And for us to straitjacket it may be a bit of overkill, but that's just my view. I think the parties must have discussions about this further and so on. It may be that, you know, because they do have some decision-making power, that you might want to keep those procedures open and so on. And not that they won't be open, but certainly, you know, you want to make certain that those procedures exist uniformly and so on. So there is an argument both ways. I think it applies probably more so when it comes to the JSC and the tribunal than it does to this committee. That's my only view. But there may be people who eventually, after you think about it, you may decide, no, look, we want to. That's what I'm saying. Don't take it out of this stage. Keep it as an option. Think about it and then come back with a considered view on it. Okay? Anything in clause 10, Mr. DeLange?
Nothing of that, Chief.
We've now dealt with 11, 12, 13.
In 14, there are really no new changes.
14.
As it was ordered. 15 also, which was left as it was. I apologize for the formatting being indicated on the document. See, no matter how hard I try, I cannot get rid of that. If I print, then it prints the format changes as well, which is really not significant. 15.
14, let me just take you back to the longer to 3A. A complaint must be based on one or more grounds referred to in subsection 4 and must and lodged by means of an affidavit or firm statement as prescribed. Now, how are you going to prescribe an affidavit? And
you'll have a form, say, a completed form, and there will be a room for the outer to be sent in this year. Will this be a form?
Yeah. seems a bit of overkill again, but okay. Okay. Fill out your forms.
I'm trying to determine the source of this insertion, but I think what whoever...
It wasn't me, I can assure you.
No, but this is a silly plan that she could do.
Well, because usually, you know, the problem is that if, for example, you're sitting in prison and you want to lay a complaint, you go and you write on a piece of paper and you get it attested to and then you send it by post. Now they're going to come back and say, sorry, could you fill out the form? You know, I mean, it just seems a bit of overkill. I think it must be a sworn affidavit, It's a different thing if somebody writes, and I know I get these complaints all the time. I'm so happy that we can ask them. Okay. Can you put that in brackets as well?
No, we can decide it out in fact, and look, if there's a problem later in practice and you feel that you actually need to.
I think so. Because, I mean, it's quite clear what an affidavit should comply with. Leave it at that. Okay. Happiness prevails. Let's go. Next.
Page 15. 15.1b is new. And we will recall that deals with a lesser complaint that can be summarily dismissed, the chairperson can ask ahead of court to deal with a complaint. Now, the problem that arose, it was argued that possibly the head of court could then decide, but I cannot dismiss this complaint out of hand, and then he might have a bit of a gap, and the idea of B is just to erase that possibility and say, but if the head of court then comes to that conclusion, he or she gives it back to the like I said, it's a bit of a question whether it's a hypothetical example, and of course you do it, the Chief Justice will have to make a value judgment before it
makes
a
Are you saying that judges don't disagree with each other? So give it back to the chairperson who insists that it is indeed a matter that may be summarily dismissed. Maybe we should make a provision for that, in which case the Chief Justice must refer it to the Portfolio Committee on Justice and Constitutional Development for a decision.
The dilemma is very nice. I don't think we should waste too much time here, but you're saying in 14.1, in the event, 14.2 rather, in the event of a complaint falling within the parameters of Section 50, within the parameters of 15, the chairperson may designate it, of course, to deal with a complaint. Now, the parameters of Section 15 can only be 15.2. It says the complaint must be dismissed if A, it does not fall within the parameters of any of the grounds set out in 14.4. B, does not comply substantially with the provisions of 14.3. C, is solely related to the merits of a judgment or order. D, is frivolous or lacking in substance. E, is hypothetical. So the Chief Justice decides this falls within those parameters, therefore give it to the head of court. The head of court sees that if it's not falling within these parameters, I need to back to you. But I read my...
Send it to Congress. No, look, I said poop. Okay.
But that is really the only thing that's new in this question, see?
Okay, that's mine.
See, the changes in 16 are really just that's just consequential. A few cross references being made, and then that is really all. And the same goes for 17. At the last meeting already, I think the Senate already changed the terminology of investigation into inquiry. That was done throughout. So that is not new. And that is really the, I think that issue on page 13. 4B, members will recall, used to read, find the respondent guilty of one or more of the complaints contemplated in section 44 in respect of which he or she was charged. The committee decided that was offensive language, and it's just been changed around to saying complaints being established, complaining that the respondent has behaved in a manner, etc. Done that on one or two occasions. On the next page, there's something new on page 14. I'm referring to subsection 8. Subsection 8 deals with a remedial step that can be imposed once it's been found that the complaint has been established, and you must act in that against that judge. 8D is new. In form of compensation, the judge may be requested to comply with any form of compensation. And in sub 9, we've added to that part, it used to be the proviso that any remedy that's likely to result in expenditure for the state must be selected from a list of remedies approved by the minister in control after consultation with chief justice. This has now been elaborated to say that the state shall not be responsible for any expenditure incurred as a result of or associated with any remedy referred to in subsection 8, E, F, or G, unless such remedy was selected from a list of approved remedies or services compiled from time to time by the Minister of Consultation and Chief Justice, and then only to the extent set out in that list. So it leaves quite a bit of scope.
Happy members? I think that's good. I think it's far more comprehensive, and
In 18, the consideration of the appeal, the only change of note is on the next page 15. We've already covered that part. It's sub 4B, Roman numeral 2, where we've just changed the wording, done away with the part saying judge guilty of one or more of the complaints, etc., etc., and substituted that with the complaint that's been established.
So where's that, Mr.
Durant? I mean, in sub 15? 4, sub page 15, 4? Sub 4. B, Roman numeral 2. It's really one something for already covered here. The wording of guilty that's being
guilty
substituted.
And charged, yes. And all
that. That's consequential of it.
Okay.
Elsewhere, and I might mention this up front, Chair, there were quite a number of instances where we saw the first judge concern, etc. I say that to respondent to us.
And that's why you added that definition.
Yeah, respondent has already defined that. Especially when it comes to the tribunal part, done there on a number of occasions. On page 16, that is the commission's clause 19. The commission is requesting the appointment of the tribunal. Nothing has changed here, except for judge concerns being substituted for respondent. And in 20, again, we've changed the respondent to the supposed judge in respect of the inquiry was held. On the next page, as you can just look at the margin there again. Consequential, the only one of note is subsection 5B there. Once again, in that provisor, which just brought it in line with the previous provision, the state shall not be responsible for expenditure incurred as a result of that provision that is just covered. It's exactly the same. In 21, nothing of any note there, Chair. 22, also no change of note, as goes 23, 24. 25, I see I've made a comment there. I'm not too sure whether it's really meant to still be in the document, but maybe I should just briefly point out to the committee what the problem is that I've picked up here. 25.1 says the Chief Justice may make rules regulating any aspect of the tribunal's activities. Then 25.3, which is a new sub-3 which is being inserted, saying the first rules made under this section must be made within 4 months from the date of the commencement of this section. And I just pointed out, I think that's a bit of I don't think that is consistent. You give a discretion as to make rules or not, you cannot say you must make the rules within 4 months.
Well, then you shouldn't say may.
May.
You must say must. And surely you must make rules. I mean, yeah. Otherwise you don't have a tribunal. And then secondly, let me just say to you that under that seal, again, you remember we said that it's not the Chief Justice that tables in terms of the rules in Parliament. It's the Minister that tables. So I've got no problem with the Chief Justice making the rules, and that I think he must make the rules. But then we must specifically say that, and the Minister of Justice must table.
I would then just suggest that you not say regulating any aspect, because that becomes a bit of an impossibility. You should just make rules regulating the tribunal
activities. Regulating a tribunal's activities. That's right.
Maybe this is a bit loosely defined. I'm not sure if we're not really rather referring to the proceedings of the tribunal or something like that.
Yeah. The rules regulating the proceedings of tribunals.
Yes, I agree.
Minister will table in Parliament, Mr. de Lambert.
Yes, then that is said. Parliament by the Minister, or shall we say the National Assembly in this instance? Back to the old.
Again. No, but this is just tabling. This
yes,
isn't called
approval. Absolutely agree. Yes.
So we can go to Parliament. You'll let me know about
yes.
This other thing because.
Dr. Delcourt is not here today.
Yeah, because as I said, we're hoping to sit on Friday again and vote.
Yeah.
See, then just one, this is really getting just a remark. I'm fairly sure that it's not in finish, but there will be a tribunal within X.
Yeah,
month.
So you're talking about the time period.
I'm talking about if it's really necessary or if it's really appropriate. But I'll leave it to the committee.
One more time.
Yes, Chair.
A little bit more time.
I'm trying to think of the purpose of this. I'm sure it would serve some purpose to make sure that if the tribunal is appointed, then there will be rules for the tribunal to guide its actions and proceedings. Maybe more time should be
6 months.
Efficient, yes.
6 months, member. Because Mr. DeLange is quite right, there isn't a standing tribunal as such. You just formulate the tribunal when it gets to the point of a request being or emerging from the JSC. But what you want to ensure is should you have that kind of scenario that you have your rules in place. There's nobody scrambling around at the time of an appointment of a tribunal trying to formulate rules. That's really what you want to do. So 6 months, I think, is reasonable, huh? Okay. Regulation.
Then, Chair, okay. There's a number of instances throughout the bill. Members will note that where we substitute a judicial officer for judge or, in some cases, respondent. That is just because the original Judicial Conduct Tribunal bill was under dealing with both magistrates and judges. But that's not the case, obviously. Otherwise, nothing in 26 and 27, 28, 29. 30, 31, 32, 33 have changed, and the same goes for 34, although I noted that in 34.1d I did change the font from italic to normal, for one instance. 35.
You've done Mr. DeLange cross-referencing check of your section, because at some stage I know that there were quite a few things that you picked up. So
that one instance I picked up 29 was changed, 28 was changed to 29. I'm fairly confident that they are correct at this point in time too, but we will definitely, probably more than once, we'll go through them when the fine tunes come. In 35, members will be visited here. It's earlier in the meeting chair, members will recall there will be under 35.1b, we will be adding a Roman numeral 3 now, which will refer to the manner in which you obtain written consent. For the purposes of section 11 from the minister. 36, there's not a single amendment to 36 too. Then this 37 goes to the secretariat of the commission. There are not many changes here, excepting 36.2b, where now we've added that subject to section 36, the secretary of the commission under the supervision, control and direction of the executive secretary. Formerly it used to be the direction supervision of the chief justice or any judge designated by the chief justice. But the executive secretary's direction is possible and accountable to the chief justice and acts under the control and direction of the chief justice. Therefore it's not necessary for the other people under the executive secretary to also account directly to the chief justice. When we come to the registrar, you will see that there is once again directed control direction by the chief justice. But in this case, say, it's fine for the secretary to be under the supervision control direction of the executive secretary. Then that B is added, must provide support to the registrar of judges of registrable interest. Sub 3 is new. Subject is section 36, which is of course our financial provisions. The registrar of judges' interest.
Why do we do it that way? The secretary of the commission. What has the secretary of the commission got to do with the registrar?
Where are you now, Chair?
In sub 2.
Sub 2.
It says the secretary of the commission. Obviously subject to the 36, which is your finances and stuff, but the secretary of the commission under the supervision, control and direction of the executive secretary must provide support to the registrar of judges' interests. I mean, that just seems strange.
Yeah, I also thought it's possibly because in 3A, you're already saying that the registrar must provide secretarial and administrative services in respect of the register. So it's possibly superfluous to have that in the issue. So I flag it for the time.
Yeah, no, this doesn't look right. If anybody is supposed to provide support to the registrar's office, because remember we are firmly lodging that registrar's office in the office of the Chief Justice. It's completely separate from the JSC. It should be the executive secretary in the office of the Chief Justice who provides that kind of support to the registrar. Because remember, it's going to be one big office, that office of the Chief Justice. Included in that staff component of the office of the Chief Justice is your registrar. Your registrar will then have to be supported by administrative staff within that office. And who is the head of that office, ultimately, is the executive secretary. The only difference is that the registrar doesn't account to the executive secretary, but the executive secretary must provide services to the registrar.
Very well,
Chief.
Can we take
to
Will you
sort that one out, the longer, and just make that clear. For the rest of 2, I think that's fine, but that particular B is problematic, okay?
Yeah, very well, Chief. Then in 3, it says, subject to 36, the registrar, under the supervision, control, direction of the Chief Judge, or any judge designated by the Chief Justice, must A, provide secretarial and administrative services in respect of the register of judges registrable interest, B, cause all records of matters dealt with by the registrar in terms of this act to be safeguarded, C, perform such functions as may from time to time be prescribed and generally perform such secretarial and administrative tasks related to the work of the registrar that may from time to time be directed by the Chief Justice or the judge designated by the Chief Justice. Then four is a broad provision, other provision.
Just explain this to me. I'm not quite sure what the subject is. This is a register of judges' interests under supervision and control of the Chief Justice or any judge designated must provide secretarial and administrative service in respect of the register of judges' registrable interests.
Yes, in other words, everything that is associated with action, with the keeping of that register.
Okay. Must perform any function or service related to the establishment or operation.
May I make a suggestion to Chair? I think if you look at the margin, you'll see it used to be formally under 2. There's a deleted sheet.
Mm-hmm.
It says maintain the register of judges' financial interests referred to in section 31.
Mm-hmm.
Shouldn't the registrar maintain
Then cause all records of matters dealt with by the registrar in terms of this act to be safeguarded. All matters dealt with all records dealt with in relation to the register. In relation to the register in terms of this act to be safeguarded. Perform such functions as may from time to time be prescribed and generally perform such secretarial and administrative tasks related to the maintenance of the register as may from time to time be directed by the Chief Justice or Judge Designated. Okay?
Then four is registered unchanged, it's just a marine number sheet. Other personnel is fine. In terms of one, to provide administrative support to the Commission, must assist the Secretary of the Commission in performing the functions of the Secretary in subsection 2. For 38, there's no amendments.
Can I just double check something? 3 months. Fine, and it's perfect. What is 4 months to achieve that one dozen?
As I understand it, four, she's really referring to that other personnel. She's 37 wanted these 3 months to sign an appropriate number of personnel, one of whom must be designated. But come to think of it, I don't think 4 months much sense, because secretary will they be there with all that other personnel. One of them will be a secretary, and the others must obviously assist the secretary. So, I think we might go for it really.
Look at that, Mr. DeLanda, look more closely. If it doesn't need to be there, take it out.
Sure.
Mr. DeLanda.
Clarification.
37 to D. Okay? Yeah. Not necessarily. Remember, there's a report to Parliament annually to do a progress report on all complaints received. So there is a register of complaints that they must keep for their administrative purposes. Because remember, what you're trying to do here is also build up a record of complaints against individual judges. So you may have, for example, a judge who swears in court, and a complaint is then lodged, and then they deal with it under your less serious things, and then they send you for a little week's course to calm your nerves or whatever. And then you come back, and then you swear again. And sometimes what is ostensibly a non-impeachable offense can then become impeachable after a period of time. So you want to have some kind of administrative record keeping.
Instead of waiting until Parliament.
They must keep those things confidential, I think, until such time as there is a report. Yeah. Now, hang on. I think there is a provision.
Or it was open to us all, even at the instant that the complaint is made.
No. Mr. DeLanda, you want to help? Yeah, I think there is something.
You've got protection of confidential information, but this doesn't necessarily qualify as confidential information unless you recognize you say that.
Cause all records of matters dealt with by the Commission in terms of this act to be safeguarded.
Dealt with.
Does that help? Not just lodged, but dealt with in terms of the register of complaints, dealt with in terms of. So that's really what you want to do. You want to keep a record of the outcome. So for follow-up purposes, for example, you send the judge and you say, to your own extent, I want you to go and spend some time at whatever court. And you want to be able to follow up that has actually been done. I mean, that's the only reason you would speak, and to obviously speak for
this. I think this provision is really aimed at safeguarding, not just information or anything like that, or possession of information. And I think the normal position will apply in the sense that if you want information, you'll have to use the Access to Information Act and obtain information. It's the only way that you can really get a copy of anything.
But what I'm trying to understand is whether this register of complaints is a register of complaints dealt with, in other words, finalized, or is it just lodging? If it's lodging, then I would have a problem with access. But if it is finalized, then it becomes a matter for public record. In any case, they're going to have to report on it in the next report, whatever. So that shouldn't be a problem for them to access.
In other words, can anybody then just find the executive session and say, what complaints are important and are being considered right now?
Even that is not necessarily confidential, because you still will have to report on the process of the
information. But in this particular point...
Why shouldn't they, is what I'm asking.
Well, that's really unraising, yeah. But you don't want to start dealing with it down the line. People make decisions that say, no, you're not entitled to that information.
I don't think that the access to information will then govern those things. I think it's fine. I don't think it needs to be confidential. Because look, they're going to have to report about this. Anyway. If something in terms of the access to information prevents that information from being shared, then clearly that legislation must be there. Okay. Where?
No, I think 38 seems to be clear, although nothing has changed in 38. Absolutely nothing. Very importantly, the 10, the long title of the Act, the Principal Act, that is, will now be just aligned with the long title of the bill, so it will be amplified along the lines of the long title of the bill. Then another fairly important amendment that is not very pertinent here, you find it in the margin, in the writing margin. Former version used to have a clause 11, which with the heading transitional provision, 11, notwithstanding the repeal of, etc. It dealt with supposed to be the existing staff of the Judicial Service Commission, but I've had very intensive discussion with those officials in the department. They assured me that we do not require this transitional provision. There are no people that need to be taken care of in terms of transitional provision, so we should just eliminate it.
Okay, so that's it. Can I take you? What is this on the next page?
So that is just when conditions are too big to be put in the margin, that is very small font in the top section, but it does larger. You can ignore that change.
Can I take you back quickly to section 17. This is your medium rare complaint, your serious but non-impeachable complaint, right? If you were to go to Roman 3, on page 14, I think it is. In your version, I think it's on page 14, I may be wrong. Can I ask you, what in principle? This is now after the chairperson has led an inquiry. formal getting. Now, you've got a situation where a formal getting was conducted, and he comes to the conclusion that this actually becomes a matter where a tribunal should be established after the formal getting. What started off as a medium surveyor kind of complaint is actually after a formal getting he comes to this conclusion. But we then say he must go to the committee who must make the recommendation. Why can't we, under those circumstances, say that the chairperson can make the recommendation directly to the JSC? Is there an in-principle problem with that in the design of this legislation? I know everywhere we've allowed the committee to do so. But remember, in many respects, this isn't a committee of the JSC per se. I mean, it just seems rather cumbersome to do it that way.
So I think the reasoning behind this was that this will be a one-member investigation or hearing, whereas the committee, that whole committee of your peers that bring make a decision, because it's a very major decision that if you come to this conclusion, you're really saying to the judge, look, if this sticks, then you will be impeached. And I think that is why the idea was to then apply section 13, I mean 16, convening a meeting, having the whole committee deciding the issue and again giving the respondent an opportunity to try and persuade the committee not to act.
It does seem, particularly on this score, after having gone through the whole formal hearing thing, you then go back to the committee again has to be persuaded, you then have to take the resolution to go to the JSC with the recommendation, would then still have to appoint the Grand Tribunal, which is going back to square one in terms of an inquiry. So it just seems a bit too cumbersome at this point. This is the one part, I think, where it becomes just too much in terms of, and I would much rather that we have a situation where, particularly if it's after a formal hearing, that the chairperson then brings the findings or submits the findings of that formal hearing to the JSC. And let the JSC then, if you want to still give the respondents an opportunity to respond to those findings, let the respondents come to the JSC and then let the JSC take a decision as to whether to proceed with the tribunal or not. You with me, Mr. Bella? Can you look at that aspect? Because I'm sure there was a reason why you guys did this. This is one of those things that we've been debating for years and years and years, and I don't want to just up front say to you that this is wrong, but it does seem to me to be unnecessarily cumbersome. There certainly doesn't seem to be any legal or substantive basis to go back to the committee and have the committee look at the matter again. So will you please look at that one for me? And I think partly it should to look at that issue. We'll discuss it again on Friday when we convene to vote for this thing. At which point Mr. Delanda will come with a more substantive response if he disagrees with me on this matter. Okay? We'll try and arrange for a meeting through the committee secretary and your chairperson for Friday to vote on this legislation. As you heard, the problem is that there isn't caucus on Thursday, so we may have to get permission from the chief whip's office and so on to look at this thing further. But it is going to be a problem if we can't pass this legislation this term. Although I don't think that there's politically in principle any problems with these. I think the opposition parties are also reasonably happy with the provisions And so I can't imagine that there's any major political problem with it. But you'll then just have to watch the space, so to speak, and you'll get notification of it. Please, if we are voting on Friday, members, please do arrive. We'll try and be very brief. We'll try and start as early as possible and finish. As you know, voting doesn't take that long. But we do suffer from forums and so on, because I know that a lot of people are not going to be in Parliament. Many workshops and so on are taking place. I know my cluster, economic cluster, is having a three-day workshop starting from Thursday. And as usual, you're not going to find many members on a Friday in the corridors and so on. So please make sure that at least the Justice Committee members are present so that we can process it. And I think this is quite an important piece of legislation also, and one would want to ensure that those people who worked on it would be here to vote on it. And we have one or two discussions that we must all have, this being one of them, the last issue. Okay? So thank you very much, and unless anybody has any questions, any comments. Tentatively, the thing has been set down to the 21st in the House.
Good day.
The department coming on the 20th.
On the 20th, but
the 21st we want to sit with our report, so that on the 23rd we can go instead of coming back. Okay. Sorry, yes.
I'm just asking whether we permanent will be communicating with the Senate of the
Sorry, I don't quite
understand.
Thursday morning. As opposed to Friday. Yeah. Yeah, look, I mean, that's a possibility. I'll have to just canvas with you. You guys don't have anything on your program for Thursday. Oh, yeah, I've got a workshop on Thursday. There is a workshop, let me just understand this, there's a workshop on Wednesday. No. In Parliament. When is Parliament's workshop? Which is the Thursday. It's Thursday. Okay. So Thursday is the workshop, that's when you guys are in the workshop. So what you're suggesting is that maybe before you get to the workshop on Thursday, we can possibly move. Do you know what time the workshop starts? Has anybody got any details about that? I don't think it should be a problem, because even if, you know, we shouldn't sit more than 30 minutes, as you rightly point out, JD. So I don't, I'll try and arrange that. Lolly isn't here.
I'm not sure.
She said she's going to be away for, oh no, she said she's writing when? She'll be back on Friday, that's too late, so we have to then arrange that. Okay, I'll have to then just speak to Eunice and try and arrange that thing for Thursday, but we'll have to obviously get permission as well. So please, Bonani's, I don't know if you got everybody's details, so that you can SMS them.
Maybe they could have
mentioned. Okay, this is a big problem, because Lolly's only coming back on Friday. Okay, let's arrange this much. I will try and SMS everybody. I think I've got everybody's numbers. I think the only person I have problem with is Mrs. Marcel. I don't know if your cell phone is what I've got. Have you been receiving my... Oh, you just ignored it. Is that what it is? Okay. No, Lisanda's not here. Oh, is she left?
No, she's three.
She's still an intern. Oh, that's interesting. That's good. Good for her. Okay. So So you'll then get an SMS from me, but you'll have to check, as I say, we may not be given permission to even debate the bill if you don't take it to corporate. So that's the one thing we have to check, and then we'll check with UNIF whether it's okay with him to convene on Thursday morning. So I will send everybody an SMS. If somebody has changed their details, cell phone wise and so on, and you don't get an SMS from me sometime today or tomorrow, please know that you must contact me, okay? So today or tomorrow you'll get an SMS from me. If you don't, you contact me. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, and we'll see each other soon. Thank you.